Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Dominic. Hello, everybody. Lovely to be here. It's been taking some palaver because, as people can probably see, I'm in a hotel room, actually in Scotland.
Tom's been kicked out.
the task of making sure that everything was up and running was considerable, and Theo ran me through my paces this morning, actually quite condescendingly. He was
astound me.
Yeah, quite condescendingly. He was obviously assumed that I would screw it up, and you know, I wasn't having any of that. And I got here and realised that I didn't have any headphones, that I'd left them behind. So I'd let Theo down, I'd let you down, Dominic. Worst of all, I'd let myself down. So a big shout out to the hotel I'm staying in at the moment. I can't remember actually what it's called, where someone...
You'll be delighted with that.
I know. But someone in the kitchen had a pair of headphones that they've lent me. So bless him.
Nice. So well, Tom, shout out to him. You're not the only person with us. So we always like to say hello to a few people that we see pop up in the comments. Jan Munters is in the house, Tom. He's here from Utrecht. Freddie from Vancouver. Anne from Godalming. Christopher from Wisconsin. Sandra from Port Hope, Ontario. Matteo from Switzerland. Mark from Santa Barbara. James Watt from Aberdeen. And Tom, your particular favourite. I'm very pleased to say that Deacon Paul O'Connor is in from
Brilliant. And did you
celebrating Assumption Mass?
Brilliant. Did you also see that Claudia Fischer is from the Teutoburger Vault, where his legions were wiped out? So
very good. That's good. Yeah. Is that the historical winner, location winner?
I'm just scrolling through the others.
Yeah. Andy from Newport Pagnell doesn't really compete.
The Battle of Newport.
Owen Geaney is in the house from Cork. I'm going to be in your neck of the woods, Owen Geaney, in a week or so, visiting my in-laws, which I'm very much looking forward to. Who else? Golly, Simeon Brown is dining in from
Cathedral.
Mendoza, Argentina. Yeah, very good cathedral.
Cathedral in Cork with all the Easter Rising.
Well, it's St. Finbar's Cathedral, and there's also a magnificent modernist church in Turner's Cross, Cork. I think Rachel Morley talked about in
one of her top 11 churches, wasn't it?
Yeah. So
Sadie's just bringing me a drink.
Oh, that's nice.
Bless her. Dominic, carry on.
Haven't been kicked out, Tom. You're actually in the hotel together, which is nice. Condescending Theo.
Thanks.
Sadie clearly enjoyed that. It's just the idea of it, isn't it, Sadie? That's so appealing.
He's gone.
Are both of you married to Irish women, says Janet Cock, and the answer is no. Sadie's not.
Although Sadie's forebears did come from Ireland.
Did they?
But her last Irish forebear was apparently in 1823 or something.
All right. So, well, if she was an American president,
yeah, that'd be fine.
All over that. Yeah.
That'd be shamrocks all around.
Yeah. Andy Graves is gutted that I've been dissing Newport Pagnell. He says Newport Pagnell has a rich and varied history. I'm actually sure it does. It's the kind of thing that you would ring me up, Tom, and say, oh my God.
Let's do
three episodes on Newport Pagnell.
Right. So, listen, we've got lots to get through today because you are doing your list. I did the top five emperors.
Yeah.
And you're doing the top 10 British prime ministers. So
I am.
And I just have to put it on the record, guys. I have to be gone by 9 because if I'm not gone by 9, I won't have anything to eat tonight because the kitchen.
Everything shuts at 9:01 in Scotland.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. And I've already presumed on the kitchen staff by borrowing all their audio equipment.
Right.
So I don't want to push my luck. So. we need to crack on. So we should just very quickly quick resume of our episodes. We've had St. Catherine of Siena.
Yeah, that was a fun one, wasn't it? That was fun is maybe not quite the right word, but that was a very lurid subject, wasn't it, Tom? I was listening to that.
It was a fascinating subject. We were driving through
New Mexico listening to that, which was a kind of weird combination.
nothing screams Catherine of Siena like New Mexico.
No. And what a weird subject that was. You had some nice feedback from Hadley Friedman of the Sunday Times,
who's written a brilliant book on it.
Yeah. About anorexia. And she gave us some nice feedback on social media about that episode. Because you made the point while you were reading out the authority, weren't you, that to call it anorexia is too simplistic because people at the time were conscious of the concept of anorexia, but they didn't think it was anorexia. Is that right? If I got that right?
they were aware that people not wanting to eat could become a disease. So the simple fact that you weren't eating wasn't in itself to brand you holy. It had to be more, you know, it had to be amplified. And there was a feeling that Christ himself, after the marriage, tells Catherine to go and eat, and Catherine has to force herself to do it. So slightly more complicated than just saying she was an anorexic.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was followed by Love Island 2, which you texted me to say that you'd enjoyed it.
I did. I'm a nice person that way.
You would obviously have taken some of those hallucinogenic drugs that they have in Mexico.
Right. And yeah, like D.H. Lawrence in Taos, the artist's colony. So Love Island was won by Tony Benn and Mary Fisher.
Yes.
Although, you still think that was the right result?
Well, so it was an alternative was run on the Discord that was actually won by Lord Nelson and Catherine Howard.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think they would be more more influencer, aren't they?
They were a more glamorous choice, Tom, but perhaps a little predictable, I would say. And we're never
predictable. Yeah, because we like to keep people, surprised.
Yeah. Yeah, a rare Tony Benn win, says Joe Evans. He's not wrong.
Yeah. And an even rarer, whatever her name was.
Mary Fisher win, yes.
Mary Fisher. Exactly.
And so next, on Thursday, we had Martin Luther King yesterday.
Oh, can I just quote Vass van der Ven? Tom can be really proud of his daughter. I am proud of her. I thought Katie did wonderfully.
And Ian Bould agrees. Ian Bould says Katie was great. Got a lot of love for Katie, Tom.
Oh, bless her. Nice.
So yesterday was Martin Luther King. Thursday is it fell off. So you're just going to have to.
It's not in any way distracting.
No. Well, hold on one second.
No, but you look like a saint. It looks like you've got a halo.
So,
and bless Daisy for saying that Katie was absolutely splendid. Bless her. So we also had Viking Sorcery.
Yeah,
before Martin Luther
King. Long awaited.
So I had a phone call this afternoon from Willie Dalrymple, who presents.
All right.
The Empire podcast.
You've been going on boats with him, haven't you?
Yes, I went to the Bass Rock, which is home to gannets, one of the great natural wonders, not just of the British Isles, but of the world, according to David Attenborough. And I went there earlier in the year and saw that somebody called Dalrymple was involved in it and wrote to Willie saying, Dalrymples get everywhere. And he said, no, my dad owns it. So his dad died, but his brother now owns it. And so he fixed for us to go over to it. It was wonderful.
Okay. And did you go with Callum, the producer?
Yeah, so Callum went. Callum couldn't have been happy. And then we came back and had an enormous pie.
All right, sounds brilliant.
So he's very happy about that. But anyway, so Willie rang up and said that he has a book by an Indian writer on the horse in India that features an entire chapter on horse penises.
And
why don't we do an episode on that? And I said I'd suggest it to you. So I'm doing that.
And now you have.
Now I have. Yeah, and what's your take on that?
Well, we'll see. Maybe one day. next Thursday is 70s New York, isn't it? And then I can't remember what's coming after that. Can you remember what's coming after that, Tom?
Dominic, Fran Brooks has just written Wittering. I think that we should except
Fran, let me be frank with you. What's different? What's changed from any other episode?
Well, I think there was quite a degree of focus and nuance in the Five Emperors that we did last time.
Well, let's see if this
can be. Your challenge now is to compete, yeah.
All right.
So you're going to do top 10 prime ministers, in your opinion.
Yeah.
And what's the rubric?
So the rubric is there's no fixed criteria. So just to give people a bit of a sense of context. So Thea's got my slides, which is nice to see. So people started doing surveys of these kinds of things in America, not in Britain. So the first survey was done in 1948 by Arthur Schlesinger Sr. And it was of American presidents. And then he did another one in 1962.
When you say survey?
Of historians, political scientists, and so on. Now, of course, there was already a physical embodiment of this kind of ranking system in Mount Rushmore, which was 1925, which has Washington, Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Lincoln. People in Britain didn't really start copying this until the 1990s, and it was pure copying. And it's never really taken off here, the idea of ranking prime ministers in the same way as presidents. I think because we don't have a sense of the president. You know, the president in the United States plays a ceremonial role. He's the commander in chief. He's the sort of embodiment of the nation as well as a partisan leader. Whereas, of course, in Britain, the prime minister is always just really a partisan leader. So the idea of ranking them,
it with kings, hasn't there? Kings and queens.
Yeah, people like doing it with kings, but prime ministers always degenerates into partisanship, which is why people are sort of probably why it hasn't really taken off to the same degree. Of course, you're doing them over a very long period of time in a very changing context. So no two prime ministers ever faced the same challenges, of course, but also to compare, I don't know, Liz Truss and Lord Liverpool, you know, they're operating in completely different environments. However, there are obviously skills that people have in common. There are recurring themes and so on. So I thought it would be a fun exercise. It's pretty, there's absolutely no claim here. I think it's spurious whenever, I don't know if you'd agree with this, Tom, when people make a great claim to sort of absolute wisdom on this front. So as I go through the 10, I mean, I could have done them in a completely different order. However, all of those caveats aside, I will go through my 10 in reverse order and you can tell me what you think. So my number 10 is Benjamin Disraeli. So he's prime minister in 1868, 1874 to 80. He's born in 1804. He's Jewish, but he converts at the age of 12. He makes his name with a great parliamentary demolition of Robert Peel over the Corn Laws, which is the removal of the kind of protectionist laws. But then actually he swings a little bit back towards the centre as prime minister. One thing I won't do, by the way, in all this is to give you too much of a kind of Wikipedia entry on each of them, because, I mean, you can look that up yourselves and we don't really have time. So the thing about
qualities that make him.
So the thing with Disraeli is it's showmanship. It's flamboyance. He is the epitome of the kind of Tory populist. He appeals to the common man in a way that previous more reactionary Tory leaders hadn't. And he does so with his own personal dandyism. So even from a young age, he wears makeup. He kind of wears outlandish clothes. He
writes novels.
He writes novels, yeah, Sybil, Tancred. So there's a slight Oscar Wilde quality to him, I think, Tom.
He's the prime minister that Boris Johnson would have wanted to be in his dreams.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah. I think there's what I think Disraeli is, which is a fascinating thing, and I think that not all political systems have this. So the United States, I don't think, really has it to the same extent, or even France. Britain has a great tradition of the prime ministerial mountebank, of the kind of the showman who is a theatrical performer, who's a bit of a charlatan. But the point of the act is that you know he's a charlatan and he knows you know.
So David Lloyd George would be another example.
David Lloyd George, and of course Boris. Boris Johnson is the supreme modern exponent of that. Obviously, what Disraeli had, which Johnson didn't, was Disraeli was also a brilliant parliamentary performer and was a pretty effective prime minister. So as prime minister, he's probably best known as the embodiment of imperialism. So he's the prime minister who makes Victoria Empress of India. And that is pure, that is the classic bit of showmanship, because it's a meaningless title. It's pure theatricality. And even
she
the
loves
time,
it.
Like, yeah, she adores it. So the case for him is that he establishes this, what comes to be called Tory democracy. They've widened the franchise. There's been a Reform Act, not just the Great Reform Act, but there's been another Reform Act in 1867. So there are more voters than ever before. And Disraeli, what he captures, which his great rival Gladstone doesn't, is the sense among a lot of British, actually working class voters, they want politics to be fun. They want it to be about brio and dash and greatness and all these things that actually Gladstone and the Liberals completely despised.
So there's a question from James Watt. Is mountebanking unique to Britain?
Silvio Berlusconi is a bit of
Berlusconi, I was thinking.
Chirac. But Chirac is more of a lounge lizard, isn't he, than a mountebank?
Yeah. Berlusconi is a mountebank.
He is a mountebank. But I think in Britain there is this very strange phenomenon where of the sort of the wink. You know that, I mean,
the
but
nudge.
This is
the musical, we all know
it's a joke, you know, that kind of thing, which Boris Johnson obviously incarnates. David Lloyd George, I mean, Lloyd George was an incredibly impressive person in lots of ways, but he was also such a corrupt. George is not in my top 10, Tom.
You astonish me. Anyway, so that's Disraeli. Should we move on to your next choice?
Who What's a Mountain Bank? Very good. Very good, Arena. great wit. So number nine is Stanley Baldwin, friend of the show, the inaugural Love Island winner, as older, more long-standing podcast listeners will remember. So he's not number one. He's number nine. Hot. Now, he wouldn't get into lots of people. No, Joe, you're all wrong. So he wouldn't get into lots of people's top tens, but I actually think he should. And that's not just because I have a great tendresse for Stanley Baldwin. Baldwin is the incarnation of kind of interwar Britain, I think. So he's prime minister three times, which is a considerable achievement. He's a very impressive person kind of morally, because, of course, he famously gives away 10% of his fortune at the end of the First World War anonymously to pay off Britain's war debt.
And he marries a cricketer, doesn't he?
He marries a cricketer. He topples Lloyd George, the man who won the war, because he sees Lloyd George as corrupt, which he was. His three spells as prime minister. In many ways, his high position is because of what he didn't do as much as what he did. So at a time when politics was incredibly inflamed in Britain in the 1920s and 30s, we will be talking about with our British fascism podcast.
Because in that, you say that actually the series on British fascism is basically about Baldwin, because it's
a lot of
fascism doesn't work.
Baldwin is brilliant at appealing to, I mean, again, like Disraeli, he's one of these politicians who is a master, or a centre-right master, of winning new voters. So in Baldwin's case, it's women. It's the new, and actually the new, so not every man could even vote before 1918. There's a widened franchise, and Baldwin is brilliant at reaching out to new voters. He's kind of the quintessentially suburban, you know, his appeal is very suburban to people in the new housing estates, that you can still, you know, so many millions, probably tens of millions of Britons still live in. The case against him is that he is seen as passive, sleepy, lax.
Well, that he
in 1930s.
That he's responsible for appeasement and for failing to rearm Britain is the charge.
He doesn't fail to rearm Britain. He does start to rearm Britain, so he starts to invest in the RAF, but he doesn't. There's a charge made in the 1940s against the governments of the 1930s that they didn't react quickly enough.
Doesn't he get booed on a train or something?
Oh, it's actually the big thing with him is his gates. He has these beloved gates of his country house in Worcestershire, and they are pulled down in this kind of very symbolic moment, almost sort of people marching on Versailles moment. They're pulled down for scrap metal during the war. And even though people had said, don't pull down Lord Baldwin's gates, you know, he deserves better than that. But they pulled them, but the government made a point of pulling them down anyway as an act of, and it was seen as an act of kind of spite. Yeah. But the key thing with Baldwin is his, he incorporates labor into the political settlement. So he goes out of his way to say to other Tories, very good, Delaclo. I'm not sure Theodora is going to be impressed with coming ninth. He goes out of his way to say to other Tories, listen, the Labour Party, good chaps. We have to work with them. We treat them with respect. We don't, you know, say that they're Bolsheviks.
Because isn't that his vibe? That everybody, the Lord and the common man, they all meet in the pub over a pint.
Yeah, that is his vibe. That is his vibe. And actually, he's not a...
It's the whole, you know, the French Revolution didn't happen in England because the Lord and the villager were playing cricket together on the green kind of thing. That's exactly what he's all about.
The paradox of Baldwin is he's a very modern politician. He is, as some people have said in the chat, his company is an ironmaster's company. It's quintessential kind of modernity. He uses the radio to address people. So he's very modern. But his appeal is based largely on nostalgia. So the country, the corn crake, you know, the smithy. Yeah.
The tinkling of hammers on blacksmiths or something.
That's right. He has these lyrical speeches. So that's enough on Baldwin because we've talked about him before. Let's go on to number eight. And that is Sir Robert Peel, Tom.
Oh, Byron's fag.
So at Eton, is that right?
Harrow.
I've just got schools on the brain because I've been researching some episodes, doing some research on public schools, Tom, for our forthcoming real Harry Potter episodes. Right. So Sir Robert Peel is interesting because he's the first prime minister from an industrial background. So he's the first political kind of manifestation of the effects, social effects of the Industrial Revolution. He was born in Lancashire. He was the son of a cotton mill owner. And do you know what his father said to him? He said, "Bob, you dog, if you don't become prime minister someday, I'll disinherit you." That's the kind of plain spoken.
That's motivational, isn't it? Is that how you talk to Sam Brooke Jr.,
I hope? Lancashire, exactly.
We're not listening to Love Island.
So he was Home Secretary under the Duke of Wellington, which is when he founded the Metropolitan Police, hence Bobbies. Not popular in Ireland, but, well, what can you do? That's true of so many of these people.
Which prime ministers were popular.
Yeah, exactly.
Tony Blair, I hope he'll be coming in at least, well, second, I hope.
Sir Robert Peel. So he issued something in 1834 called the Tamworth Manifesto, which is the statement of pragmatic conservatism. It's the first real statement of pragmatic conservatism. He says we have to, and I quote, reform to survive, which, of course, has become the great watchword of the Tory party, Britain's most effective party. When he's in office, he turns out to be quite a reforming prime minister. Factory reforms, crucially Catholic emancipation. So that's a pretty big thing. But the massive thing deal with him is the repeal of the Corn Laws. So it sounds like it's the sort of thing, Tom, that you would say, God, that sounds very so boring. Yeah. But the Corn Laws are very important because they are basically protectionist tariffs that protect
the
interests.
You start saying tariffs.
But they, what they do, Tom, is they are trying to preserve in aspic a dead Britain, a Britain that was based on agriculture and the peasantry and landowners. And, of course, Britain by the 1840s is not that. It's the country of Manchester and Birmingham and big cities and railways and things. And Peel recognises that although lots of big landowners are Tory backers, they have to ditch the Corn Laws because the people of the cities want cheap food, want imported food. He does so. He destroys his own career and splits his party in 1846.
Because the Tories are then out of power for 30 years?
They're basically then the second party in British politics for, you could argue, for the rest of the 19th century. Well, even arguably until the Marquess of Salisbury in, what, 1880s, 1890s? So actually, it's Peel is inadvertently the founder of you could argue he's the founding father of the modern Conservative Party, but also the founding father of the modern Liberal Party, because the Peelites, the people who back free trade, they end up becoming one of the founding forces in the new Liberal Party, which emerges.
So these are the Orange Bookers in the Liberal Democrats.
Right, exactly. So that's Robert Peel. He destroys himself for the good of the country, I think it's fair to say. That's why he's not higher. And he's quite a chilly person, Tom, which is also why he's not higher. So that's why he doesn't really have much purchase on the popular imagination. Okay, number seven is a great favourite of mine. We've mentioned him before, and the rest is history.
You see, I don't know why you have this passion for him. He seems a terrible Prime Minister.
No, he's brilliant. He's brilliant. He's Prime Minister.
And he presides over a virtual civil war, and then he takes Britain into the First World War. And he spends the whole time writing, mooning over
interfering with girls.
Okay, big him up.
Okay, so Asquith. Asquith is the great reforming prime minister of the 20th century, even more than Clement Attlee, I think, in some ways. So he's one of the two or three cleverest people on this list. He comes from a nonconformist background, so dissenting background, not Church of England, in Yorkshire. He's middle class. He is a lawyer. So he's born in 1852. He comes into Gladstone's Liberal Party. Gladstone who's a pretty good judge, has an enormous respect for Asquith's intellect. And he would say of Asquith, so this is the sort of 1890s, when he was in trouble in the debate, he would say, "Send for the sledgehammer. Bring me the sledgehammer." The sledgehammer was Asquith, because Asquith was so clever and such a powerful debater that he would just sweep all before him. He becomes prime minister in 1908, and he is the incarnation of what was called the New Liberalism. So those of our listeners who are American will perhaps spot some resemblances with progressivism, with the progressive era of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. So unlike previous Gladstonian liberals, Asquith is all about using the power of the state to achieve social ends. So it is Asquith. It is not the Labour Party in the 1940s, but is Asquith who basically creates the foundations of the welfare state, who old age pensions, national insurance, for example. And people are in awe of Asquith's intellect and his power and his sort of, he's just his formidable, formidable kind of quick, cerebral, powerful nature.
But Dominic, now, yeah, so question.
What goes wrong?
Quite a lot goes wrong. Yeah. So we did a whole episode with Dan Jackson on basically the fact that the United Kingdom, under his premiership, is on the brink of civil war, and then he proves a disastrous war leader in the First World War.
Yeah,
and I would say that both those things. I mean, presiding over, allowing your country to slip into a condition of civil war, and then being a terrible war leader, these are not positives.
Well, first of all, the Civil War issue, the Ireland Civil War issue. Actually, if our listeners go back and they listen to that episode with Dan Jackson or the previous one with Paul Rouse, it's pretty obvious that this was not a situation that any prime minister could have, you know, there's no magic wand that will fix it. So if you look at all the big names in those episodes, Asquith, Lloyd George, Churchill, these are the big beasts of 20th century British politics, and they can't fix the Ireland issue. It's not neatly fixable in this way. So I don't think Asquith can really be, I mean, he's constantly putting things off and he's struggling. He's trying to find wheezes. But don't forget, he's got the issue of women's suffrage. He's got trade union unrest. He's trying to get these radical reforms in the people's budget past the House of Lords. So he's got loads of stuff going on all at once. This takes an enormous toll on him, Tom. So I think by 1914, he is drinking. He's knackered. I mean, so this is a picture of him when he's a little bit younger.
He looks to underage girls in chat rooms.
Yeah, exactly. There is a bit of a kind of Me Too thing going on with Asquith, and of course, and his daughter's friend Venetia Stanley, and all this kind of business. Is he a terrible war leader? Is he a uniquely terrible war leader? Again, I think that's really unfair. Almost all the people who led their countries into World War One were not prepared for the scale of the challenge. And the other thing was, of course, that Asquith's liberalism was blown away by the First World War. That's not his fault. He believes in a creed that the First World War, with the demands of total mobilization, makes impossible. So everything he stands for crumbles, and that's not his fault. It's a historical necessity, I suppose. Go on, sorry, Tom.
Could you not argue that your Lloyd George phobia is blinding you to the fact that a lot of the radicalism of the Liberal government comes from Lloyd George, and that Lloyd George is a vastly more effective war leader than Asquith, and that the challenge of winning the First World War is the greatest challenge that Britain faces, and that therefore Lloyd George should properly be ranked ahead of Asquith?
No, Lloyd George is Asquith's number two. Lloyd George undoubtedly burns with a radical fire, but Lloyd George would not have been in a position to carry out the reforms as he did as Chancellor were it not for Asquith's patronage. So Lloyd George actually was already pretty damaged goods before the war even started because of his involvement in the Marconi scandal.
So it's his corruption and his dodginess.
His dodginess, yeah, predates the war. I think he wouldn't have got where he had without Asquith's patronage. Lloyd George then turns on Asquith like a snake, Tom, and stabs him in the back, if a snake can stab.
They did used to have legs, snakes.
Did they?
Yeah.
So they could use back their the toes to hold a weapon?
Yeah,
Didn't expect the podcast to take this turn. Anyway, I think that the truth is we give Arena, who doesn't like Asquith, I mean, do your own podcast if you don't want to spend so many minutes on Asquith. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. So should we move on?
Yeah.
I'm
dissing the Wangs now.
Yeah. I'm trying to rein you in. And Dominic, you're also getting a lot of grief for not having any Labour leaders. So
really?
Now is the time to introduce Tony Blair.
Right. So number six is Clement Attlee. Now, Attlee and the next person on the list, I think, are pretty much interchangeable. I've had them a six and five, but they could be five and six. The thing with Labour, of course, I mean, don't forget, there are 300 years of British prime ministers, and Labour prime ministers are only present in the third of those centuries, and actually not very often. So there's not that many Labour prime ministers to choose from, and I think it would be foolishly present-minded to sort of wait it just because Labour are now a big party, which of course they weren't until the 1920s. Attlee won our World Cup of Prime Ministers, which I think is pure present-mindedness, actually. He's a very, very impressive man. Born into a conservative family, goes to public school, which he adored his public school, Haileybury. He cared about Haileybury probably more than anything. It goes through this conversion experience. Like a lot of public schools, Haileybury had a house in the East End of London. It had a charitable foundation called Haileybury House. Attlee goes off there and he's completely converted by working with poor kids and things. So he moves to the left. He serves in the First World War. He got dysentery at Gallipoli. He was wounded by shrapnel in Mesopotamia. So he's got a great war record, very patriotic. He comes back and he becomes mayor of Stepney. Then he becomes a Labour MP. And then when the Labour Party falls apart in the 1930s, versus Stanley Baldwin, Attlee comes in as leader. He's called Major Attlee at the time. And everyone thinks he'll be a caretaker, but he stays around for ages. Churchill's deputy in Second World War. Now, why is he this high on the list? Some of our international listeners may be wondering, because he's not very famous. He's not very famous internationally. And even in Britain, he's not nowhere near as well known as Churchill or Lloyd George, I would say. Because Attlee's Labour government, they build on Asquith's welfare state to build a much bigger welfare state. They build their National Health Service. Of course, everybody loves our NHS, Tom. He nationalises loads of things. He helps to set up NATO. He gets Britain into the Cold War. And he's altogether a very upstanding, respectable, impressive, admirable man. He's very modest. As Evan Byrne rightly says, his wife drove their car when he went campaigning because he couldn't drive. She was a terrible driver. People always used to say, you know, when the Attlees were campaigning, basically, lock up your kids. It's like she's careering all over the road. And she voted Conservative, would you believe?
Wow, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Well, they were both from Conservative families. This is one of the interesting things about Attlee. Hmm. And Attlee personally is a very small-C Conservative person.
He loved cricket. So wasn't there something that there was some ticker tape thing?
The only reason he had a ticker tape installed in number 10. They could keep up with the test scores. So Attlee's government creates the foundations for a lot of post-war Britain. The case for him is that rarely in modern British history has any government so clearly asserted the sort of the power of the state to improve people's lives. The case against him is they make a terrible mess of the independence of India and lots of people die. The story that's actually not really ever really talked about in Britain, partition, which happens under Attlee's watch. The Labour Party, he doesn't establish a kind of political hegemony, as a lot of the other people on this list do, and certainly the people who are above him. So after he loses 1951, Labour out of power for 13 years. So he doesn't, you know, you've got to leave a legacy, Tom. You've got to leave legacy as well as a policy one.
Fran Brooks makes an excellent point that he looks like Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart is too tall, I think, and too imposing, and has too rich a voice.
But his face, I mean, his expression in that photo, he definitely looks like he should be on the Enterprise.
Do you know what? Wenzel R. makes a point that we in Britain are very reluctant to admit. So 8:34 p.m., Theo, if you want to, maybe you're too embarrassed as a Briton to highlight Wenzel's remark. He says the NHS actually isn't very good. And of course, the thing about the NHS is people in Britain swoon about the National Health Service and regard it as one of the great wonders of the world, but nobody else in the world ever copied it. Ever copied our system. And there is an argument that some of Attlee's landmark decisions, the nationalisation, the foundation of the NHS, they actually ended up bequeathing Britain with a lot of problems. So I would argue that investing all of that political capital on nationalising dying industries like coal mining, for example, or shipbuilding or whatever, was a bad decision. And it's understandable that they made that decision in the late 1940s. But a bad decision. The other thing about Attlee, why I've marked him down a bit, is that unlike a lot of people on this list, he doesn't leave much of a personal impact. So, Tom, can you remember? Well, Prince of Pelican.
The empty car turns up and
Clement Attlee got out. Yeah, which Churchill did not say, but everyone thinks that Churchill did say it. The great Churchill Attlee anecdote is that Churchill was in the House of Commons loos, the urinal. And Attlee came in. Sorry, I've got it the wrong way around. Attlee was at the House of Commons loos at the urinal. Churchill came in. Churchill went and stood at the other end of the urinals, Tom. And Attlee said to him, "Oh, Winston, you know, we may disagree, but surely, you know, we should be friends and that, you know, we should be able to stand together."
The privacy of...
Exactly. And yes. Churchill said to him, "I know you socialists, Clem. Whenever you see something that's big and works well, you want to nationalize it."
So that's very good.
So I was almost...
You really say that? It sounds...
No, exactly. Almost certainly not true. Okay. So that's number six. And I did say that number six and number five could easily swap places based on your personal preference. So number five is... Ta-da!
So there's been grumbling on the from the Wangs that this None is going women. Very Daily Mail. So you've
really
you've got to go in hard here on just...
Well, I'm the expert.
You are the expert. You've written books on it.
So Thatcher. What about that? What can you say about Thatcher? She's grammar school. She's arguably the first scientist to become prime minister. She's of course the first woman. It's sort of... She's so divisive, of course, that it's kind of pointless trying to drop a
I entirely see what you mean about Attlee and Thatcher, that entire, you know, you could absolutely swap those around. And in a way, they're kind of linked, aren't they? Because
they are.
Thatcher saw herself as healing the damage that she saw Attlee as inflicting. And people who think that Thatcher was a disaster look back to Attlee as the shining example
exactly
of what
right.
was destroyed exactly. by her government.
Exactly. So you could easily swap them around. And I've put her above Attlee for a couple of reasons. One, because I think as the first woman, she is facing personal obstacles that Attlee never did. Attlee is a public schoolboy at a time when actually there are quite a lot of public schoolboys in the Labour Party. In fact, there was a joke, I only came across it today. In 1947, somebody said to Attlee's Chancellor, Hugh Dalton, "What do you have to do to get into the cabinet? I was expecting to get into the cabinet after the latest reshuffle." And Dalton said, "Well, ideally you should have been to Haileybury, but if not, Eton will do, or Harrow." So Attlee is part of an establishment where he would go to the clubs. He's part of a world where he knows all the Tory people, he knows the Liberals and so on and so forth. Mrs. Thatcher is much more of an outsider. So I think the personal achievement of becoming Prime Minister is greater. Attlee has a habit of losing lots of elections. So he lost in the 1930s, and then he calls elections at the wrong time, and of course he loses badly in 1951. Mrs. Thatcher only ever loses the leadership election, Tory leadership election in 1990, and even then it's not... she doesn't lose it, she just doesn't win it by enough. So she's a winner, which I think advances her a little bit.
And she wins the Falklands.
Well, she wins a war. I mean, Attlee fought in, you know, he had fought personally. And of course, he took Britain to the Korean War. So, you know, he's a war leader too, and he was number two in the Second World War. So I think that's pretty impressive. I think
Mrs. Thatcher didn't actually fight in Mesopotamia.
Exactly. One second, while I put my light on.
Although she was very keen on going to war.
There we go. So what I think.
Why is everyone that advances Thatcher, Dominic? We have answered this one before.
We have, I think, because to call her Thatcher. Certainly in the 1980s when I was growing up, carried an electric charge. So only people who disliked her called her Thatcher. The BBC and the newspapers called her Mrs. Thatcher, which was neutral, and her admirers called her Maggie or Mrs. T. Now, it'd be ludicrous to call her Maggie or Mrs. T. But I think, I don't know whether you'd agree with this, Tom, we're of a similar generation. When people say Thatcher...
No, we did, because we discussed this on the Falklands.
Yeah,
we mutually agreed that Mrs. Thatcher was the most neutral way of describing her.
Stephen Little, he did win more of the popular vote in 1951. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. But he didn't win the election. I mean, that's the game. You can't... it's not counted by popular vote. So Martin, what's his name? Martin Pugh, in his brilliant History of the Labour Party, Speak for Britain. If you're interested in Labour Party politics, you should look at this book, because he argues that Attlee was actually a bad leader of the Labour Party. And I think he writes as a Labour Party supporter. He says Attlee kept calling elections at the wrong time. He was not a good tactician. Right. Mrs. Thatcher, the other thing about her, the arguments in the chat about the policy, in many ways, is, I think, irrelevant for ranking prime ministers, as it would be for any other, for Roman emperors, Tom. Because, of course, at any distance, the policies recede in importance. So, you know, if we were arguing about Gladstone and Disraeli, who cares about the policies? in a way, their historical significance. It's about iconography, and it's about kind of symbolic importance and what they come to represent. Now, Mrs. Thatcher's case, she becomes an extraordinary icon. And at her peak in 1982, 1983, she's an icon of Britishness. Most of the time, she's, of course, intensely divisive, but lots of success.
But she's also, very divisive. Towards the end of her term, she becomes an icon of the Western Alliance, doesn't she? All that dressing up in fur and going to Moscow.
Right, people in Eastern Europe, you know, still lots of people do, still all over are people in America.
She's probably the most internationally recognised Prime Minister since Churchill, would you say?
Yeah, I without any question. Is there anyone? Tony Blair would be her only rival. Tom, it's at this point that I have to tell you, Tony Blair is not in the top 10.
What?
Tony Blair's not in the top 10. I don't think he's actually as important as most of these others. And his biggest decision was a complete and utter disaster. You just have to face the facts, Tom. The other crucial thing about Tony Blair, of course, is he is very much operating in Thatcher's framework. He is Thatcher's heir in a way that Thatcher was not at.
I think you've made your case.
So we have four to go. We have four to go. Now, these four, I would argue, are in a league of their own, clearly ahead of. Some people regard this as controversial. Clearly ahead of the other contenders, and actually, I think any of these four could be number one. However, there has to be a number four, Tom, and that man is William Pitt the Younger. So, Pitt becomes Prime Minister at the age of 24. Yeah. 24, extraordinary, and he. He has an unrivaled command of the House of Commons, even as a very young man.
As your Prime Minister.
So there's been decades of corruption, late 18th century politics. He is elevated because he is seen as a clean pair of hands. People call him Honest Billy. He's a brilliant manager of the Commons. He's a great pragmatist. He's particularly brilliant at finance. So he creates the sinking fund to pay off the national debt. He introduces a progressive income tax at the end of 1798 to fight the war with France. It's Pitt the Younger who gives Britain the state that allows it to beat France in the Napoleonic Wars. Of course, he doesn't live to
and
the end.
There's something about windows.
A window tax. I think I don't. But does he do the window? I think the window tax precedes him. I might be wrong. I'm not an expert on the window tax, so listeners who do know about window taxes can put me right. As one person wrote at the time after he died, his conduct in Parliament had a mixture of prudence, firmness, and transcendent ability never before seen and hardly ever again surpassed. So what kills Pitt, he dies because of overwork, just the enormous strain of marshalling state power in a way that had never been done in any European state to win the war, to win this massive world war against first revolutionary France and then Napoleonic France. He's also, Tom, as we discussed before, a three-bottle man, isn't he?
He loves port.
So port. So he suffers from gout and terrible inflammatory diseases.
And he's prescribed it medically, isn't he? His doctor says, three bottles of port for you.
Yes, that's right. He dies at the age of 46. The case for him is that he is the supreme parliamentary manager and financial wizard of late 18th century Britain, without whom the war against Napoleon, this absolutely titanic war, would not have been won. The case against him... go on, Tom.
Just to say, I know, I'm guessing that who another of the top four will be, but there's a case for saying that Pitt's achievement in winning a must-win war for Britain... He is more responsible for the day-to-day administration and functioning of this kind of Leviathan, the British state at war, than any other prime minister.
Well, that's a good comparison, Tom, because what Pitt doesn't have that other person that we're clearly both thinking of does have. Pitt's not a great speechmaker to the public. He doesn't become a great icon. There is a kind of chilliness to him. He doesn't have close friends. He's all about politics, and he's not, and he doesn't, you know, no one now says, oh, I'm a Pitt the Younger conservative or whatever. I mean, that would be a laughable thing to say. So he doesn't have that kind of cultural.
William Hague was very keen on Pitt the Younger, though, wasn't he?
Yeah, he wrote a book about
him. Biography of him.
I think because William Hague had become Tory leader at the age of seven.
When he was 10.
Whatever it was. Yes. And the fact that Pitt had become Prime Minister at 24. endeared William and Pitt, endeared them to one another, although you know what I mean. Okay, so that's Pitt the Younger. Now, my number three is another. He was a great contender, actually, Tom, in the Rest Is History's World Cup of Prime Ministers. Did he get to the final? He got to the final, didn't he?
The one that I'm thinking of. Is he? Yes, there, it is.
There
yes,
he is. He did. So he's William Gladstone.
In a succession of very highly fought battles. So it was, you know, it was always ended kind of 12.
There was a titanic derby against Disraeli, wasn't there?
Yeah.
So Gladstone could easily be number one, actually. Roy Jenkins. So he was a, for those people who don't know, he was a great, massive political figure of the 1960s and 70s in Britain. He wrote two massive biographies of Gladstone and Churchill, and he could never really decide which was he thought was the bigger figure. Gladstone is the he's here really because he's the he's not just a brilliant administrator, great parliamentarian, all this. He's the incarnation of Victorian Britain, isn't he, Tom, of high-mindedness. He started out in politics as the highest of high Tories, but he was one of these people who joined the Peelites after the repeal of the Corn Laws, and then ends up becoming a liberal, becomes leader of the Liberal Party. He is intensely religious. So even when
he's staggering, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry. You said that he's the embodiment of Victorian Britain, and Victorian Britain is the greatest empire that the world has ever seen in terms of landmass and naval reach. And yet he is instinctively hostile to empire. I mean, it seems an incredible paradox.
It is. It's an extraordinary thing.
And is that tied up with his religion?
I think almost certainly, He is the soul of high-mindedness. So Disraeli, his great rival, loves imperialism, loves empire, loves the show of it and the greatness and the swagger. Gladstone's very conflicted. Of course, if you remember when our General Gordon podcast, Gladstone's nickname was the GOM, the Grand Old Man, and people called him the MOG, the Murderer of Gordon, because he wouldn't intervene to help Gordon in the Sudan.
Because people have been complaining that there aren't enough Labour politicians, but it's clear that Gladstone is really the political grandfather of Tony Benn, and therefore, I suppose, Corbyn, and that kind of internationalist, anti-imperial tradition on the left.
Yeah, I think he absolutely is. He does loads of things in office. So unlike Tony Benn and Jeremy Corbyn, he has a whole list of achievements. He reforms the army. He reforms the civil service. He reforms local government. He passes laws governing trade, giving trade unions rights. He institutes the secret ballot. He creates the appeal courts. He does all of these kinds of things. He also, Tom, as we both know, tours the streets rescuing fallen women and then flagellating himself, which is the one thing that most people get very excited about with Gladstone.
Well, they see that
as emblematic. They see that as part of, as people see that, don't they? Ever since Lytton Strachey and eminent Victorians in the 1920s, people have seen this as hypocrisy.
But I don't think Gladstone was a hypocrite. We've moved on from that, haven't we?
Yeah.
We've moved on from that. We accept that these are genuine expressions of religious impulse and doubt.
Yeah. I think no prime minister is as formidable or as impressive as Gladstone. Victoria hates him because Victoria likes fun. Victoria likes becoming Empress of India. She wants to be loved. She says Gladstone, she famously said, Mr. Gladstone talks to me as though I were a public meeting. So Gladstone goes in and he addresses her and he talks to her about his high-minded rectitude and financial probity and the importance of clean living and all the, exactly, Dan Scott put his nail on the head. Disraeli made her laugh and said, I've got a new country for you to be empress of. Whatever. And yeah, there you go, Glenn Binney. Exactly right. So Gladstone is number three. Now, number two is the person who a lot of people may have expected to be my number one, because they'll say, oh, Mr. John Bull, Daily Mail, he's bound to have Churchill as number one. But no, Churchill is number two.
So room is left for James Callaghan.
What can you say about Churchill? We've obviously done our young Churchill episodes. He's now become a very controversial figure. He played almost every part across the political spectrum. When we return to Churchill's career, hopefully in 2024, we'll be doing him as the kind of liberal firebrand, as the great radical. But of course, he's also the great imperialist, very reactionary at times, just all over the shop. But he is here in the list because of his. It's a very unusual case, actually, because of all its 10 people, they all had remarkable achievements to their credit. Churchill is more wrong about more than any. than any of the rest of them.
He has one transcendent achievement.
Yeah. And most of these people actually have domestic reforms to their credit of one kind or another. So they change things domestically. Churchill doesn't really. He's a do-nothing prime minister in that sense. But as you say, one transcendent achievement that looms so large in the British national consciousness that it would seem almost perverse, I think, to rank him lower.
Well, it is an achievement that is not merely a British achievement. I mean, it serves to ultimately ensure Europe's freedom.
Right. There's no. It's not an accident that when you go to
good stuff, town, from Daisy.
What's Daisy say in his own terms? Churchill is a failure. Well, of course, this is the John Cholmondeley argument that Churchill, the end of glory. Churchill was a huge imperialist who oversees British global decline. The global decline was happening even before Churchill was prime minister, Daisy. So the Government of India Act in 1935 was arguably the big nail in the coffin. And Churchill bitterly resisted it. But Churchill didn't see himself as a failure. And people at the time didn't see Churchill as a failure. I think that those are two key things. So first of all, in the 1940s, when Britain was obviously being eclipsed by the United States and the Soviet Union, nobody says, oh, God, what a waste of space Winston Churchill is. What a fool. You know, OK, we won the war, but I mean, we've lost the bigger issue. No one says that. Equally, when he dies in 1965, nobody says, oh, what a terrible failure Churchill is. In fact, people across the political spectrum, Clement Attlee, who's one of his pallbearers at his funeral in 1965, people agree he's a remarkable person who, for that period between 1940 and 1945, incarnated a spirit of national resistance.
I mean,
that nobody else could have done.
I wonder if possibly you had to have lived through the experience of imagining that the Nazis might win the war to have a proper sense of the scale of his achievement.
Yeah. I mean, when you get back to the sources from 1940, 1941, there's no escaping it. You know, Labour MPs were writing in their diaries after his speeches in the Commons, you know, his speech is worth 1,000 guns. Amazing accounts of him, the wonderful scene where he addresses a load of MPs. It's not in the Commons. I think it's the Tory party. And he says to them, if this island story of ours is to come to an end, let it come when we are all choking in our own blood on the ground. And everybody cheers and people are sobbing. I mean, of course, it's an act of kind of suspension of disbelief to some. You know, they're projecting onto Churchill what they see as these bulldog virtues. But only he could have played that part so successfully. Of course, it's the Labour Party who put him into office because they want him as leader. And they were right to want him, I think. Alan Brooke, who worked with him, said, with him, England has been on the verge of disaster time and again. But without him, England was lost for a certainty. And I think that's a nice way of putting it. Roy Jenkins, Labour Chancellor, said of him, I put Churchill with all his idiosyncrasies, his indulgences, his occasional childishness, but also his genius, his tenacity, and his persistent ability, right or wrong, successful or unsuccessful, to be larger than life as the greatest human being ever to occupy 10 Downing Street. And so I think that's good, but that's not good enough for me, Tom.
So what colossus?
Yeah.
What colossus has kept Churchill from the top spot?
So actually, to me, the more I think about this, the more convinced I'm right that the number one choice is, of course, no, it's not Tony Blair. It's absolutely not Tony Blair. Very good, Theo.
Very good, Theo.
You missed the slide, Theo. It's Sir Robert Walpole. He's the first prime minister. He was born 1667. He's the Norfolk Squire. He went to Eton and Cambridge. Eton, like so many prime ministers. He came into government. He was in government around there and thereabouts in the 1710s. But he really comes in after the South Sea Bubble, this kind of incipient stock market crash in 1721. And he is there for 21 years and not by accident. He staves off the threat of Jacobitism. He manages Parliament. He keeps George I happy. He is the first prime minister in that sense. So there had been chief ministers before. The two most famous are the Earl of Godolphin and then Robert Harley, the Earl of Oxford, under Queen Anne. So some people sometimes say of those two, they were really the first prime minister. But Walpole is the first person who occupies the office for a long period of time, runs the ministry, controls the patronage networks. And he does so at a time when Britain has just been created as a country, and it is ascending to an extraordinary heights never before. You know, when we did the 100 Years War podcast, Tom, you made the point really powerfully about what a piffling country England was compared with France. Under Walpole, Britain for the first time can actually stand and look the French in the eye as equals.
Well, and I think that justifies his position.
The other things about him, he keeps Britain out of war for the majority of the 20
sleeping
years.
Dogs lie, right?
Like, sleeping dogs lie is his exactly that. He says, let's not mess in. Tom, you've got 4 minutes. Don't worry. We won't go intervening in lots of wars and stuff. Let's keep out. Let's just get rich. He keeps taxes low. He's moderate. He avoids controversy. I think he's also a fascinating figure because, like so many successful prime ministers, he's always playing a part. So he plays the part of the country squire. I mean, it's quite the Baldwinian kind of part, actually.
Tom. I mean, his belly in that is very much that.
So when he goes into the Commons, what he'll do is he sits there and he ostentatiously takes out a load of apples from his country estate and kind of munches them while people are talking. And then he boasts that the first correspondence he always turns to, and he often reads it in the Commons and allows other people to see that he's reading it, are the reports from his gamekeeper. So, you know, this sort of playing the part.
Well, this is
really,
all tremendous
really...
stuff. But Dominic, just to play devil's advocate, you've been very hard on Lloyd George for his corruption.
Yeah.
But Walpole is not exactly uncorrupt, is he?
No, the Robinocracy, as it was called. A lot of people really thundered against Walpole's corruption.
The Beggar's Opera is a...
Beggar's Opera, kind of exactly. I love the Beggar's Opera. Shoveling wealth into his own pocket, says Roland Miner. Shocking scenes. Yeah, but I think this was a corrupt... The 18th century is an intensely corrupt age. The complaints about corruption, I think, come from people who basically want to have their hands on the loot but aren't getting it because they're not part of that particular network. I don't think it's the principle of corruption that's so much the issue as the outs complaining about the ins, as it were.
So he did it, and he was right to do it.
I mean, he was the fact that he's prime minister for 21 years and the fact that he sets his stamp on the age, an age of... which has now vanished from the British national imagination, but is arguably the age of our ascent to greatness, I think elevates him among, Clement Attlee was Prime Minister for 6 years. Walpole was Prime Minister for 21.
Well,
how can they be compared?
I mean, in a way, it's a bit like the Antonine Peace, that the fact that there are no great wars, that there are no great catastrophes, in a way... And so, therefore, he's not remembered, is the ultimate tribute to him.
Yeah, absolutely right, Tom. I think that's absolutely right. It was the period that laid the foundations for everything that followed. And that's why I think he is the top dog.
He's the opposite of Liz Truss. He's the anti-Liz Truss.
He is. Yeah, no Liz Truss in the... So Liz Truss is the worst. I think there's no question Liz Truss is the worst. Because I don't think you can be prime minister for such a short period of time and fool
blow everything up
by your fool by your own hand, and then claim Liz Truss is not.
But that's a terrible thing to have as your legacy, isn't it? The worst prime minister of all time.
But she has to go, as we said before, Tom. She has to go to remembrance services
forever. So that's the worst prime minister of all time.
Well, no, because eventually people will just say, "Who's that?"
No, because being the worst prime minister of all time is a status. People will remember her long after they've forgotten all the others.
Titmus is quite wrong.
So Lord North is remembered, for instance. I mean, he's probably the only 18th century prime minister that people remember.
But Lord North was not a terrible prime minister.
Yeah, I know. But
he just carries the can for...
And also, as Adam Smith
was saying, Lord North just kept wanting to resign. Lord North didn't even want the job.
I know. But still, he is remembered as a seismic... I mean, he's... customarily held up as the worst prime minister ever. That's why he's remembered. And now there's a new kid on the block.
I'm just going to answer a very quick question, an important question from Patrick Carter. He says, okay, but who would you choose in a contest between Lord Palmerston and Pitt the Elder? So this is the Simpsons, of course, great fans of Lord Palmerston. I would choose Lord Palmerston because Pitt the Elder was unsound on the issue of the North American tax dodgers. Tom.
So. Yeah. Well, but Pitt the Elder as Foreign Secretary rather than as, or whatever he was, rather than as Prime Minister.
Right. As,
over the entire course of his career, because he is basically the guiding hand in
the Seven Years' War. Yeah. So
I think we did too quickly.
Well, we did.
I'd like to do the 7 Years' War in more detail.
Do you know what I would like to do next year, Tom? I don't want to jump the gun on our next scheduling meeting, but I would like to do a couple of episodes on the Battle for Quebec to please our Canadian listeners.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. Well, we've got an invitation, haven't we, to go to Quebec House?
I think we should just go to Quebec.
I know you really don't want to go to North Kent, but...
Oh, it's not this again.
We could go to Chartwell, we could go to Quebec House, and then we could go to Chatham, the Chatham High Street and the Raid of the Medway. Brilliant. Four episodes. Bang.
Unbelievable. I can't believe that such a magisterial tour of Prime Minister history ends. Yeah,
it's brilliant. You're like playing into walking into Lake Trasimene.
Right.
Ambushed.
James Watt.
No, Dominic, that was brilliant.
James Watt says, do not bump Shakespeare. We won't bump Shakespeare, will we, Tom?
No, we're not going to bump Shakespeare.
Good.
I'm cogitating away furiously on Shakespeare. Brilliant. I know what we're going to do.
Brilliant.
Look, guys, I've got to go and eat or else I'm going to starve.
Yeah. Tom,
Tommy starve.
Puts his appetite above the interests of the Rest is History Club.
Yes, I do. Dominic, do you want to stay here and continue your lecture?
Do you know what? I'm going to go and watch Stranger Things.
Are you? Okay. Is that the latest series?
No, we have been rewatching series 1 to 4 with the son and heir.
It's quite
massively
scary, isn't it?
It's very scary. It's very inappropriate, actually.
Especially the third one where, or is it the one where Sam gets...
Sam?
The guy who plays Sam in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, you don't spoil it for people. Sean asked him. That was shocking. Bob Newby.
Yeah.
Tom, I felt actually... the first time I saw that, I went to wake up the next morning and I just felt such a leaden sense of loss.
The ring has been taken.
That was such a sad.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen,
guys, I can't stay here and talk about strange things.
Right.
So thanks ever so much. apologies. What was I missed that?
Very good. Put that up again. James Watt. I think it was James Watt anyway. Will the Rest is History continue in the future with Arthur and Katie?
Yeah, we can have a dynastic marriage.
Definitely. Definitely. He's at the age now where I would betroth him. I would happily betroth him.
Well, Katie or Eliza. You've got the choice.
Brilliant.
All right. So see you all. Thanks so much for coming. And
thank you, as always, for all your
about
support.
The fact that everywhere around here seems to shut very early.
You can blame the Scottish hospitality industry.
No, it's the same in England. Same in Northumbria.
Is it? It's just the north, isn't it, Tom?
There was one time where everything shut at 4.
It's just northerners of one kind or
very,
another.
Very abrupt.
Right.
Anyway.
Everybody, listen, thank you so much, as always, for being members of the Rest is History Club. Thank you for all your feedback. Thank you for all your bonus questions, which we are trying and obviously, we're failing to get through.
But we're going to be doing another stash, so that will be going out fairly soon. So we will see you very soon, and I'm going to go because I'm going to...
Go on, Tom. Go and have some dinner. Bye-bye. Bye, everybody.